Session number 10012, Reel 2.
Mr. George Clayton, Reel 2. What did you do when you'd finished at the brick-making plant?
Well, I went away. Oh, I wanted to be an engine man.
No, I mean in the evening. Sorry, that's my fault.
Eh?
In the evening, when you got home.
Oh, well, when we got home, I did attend evening classes for a while. I attended evening classes on shorthand. And also on keeping books. I thought maybe lead to something better than where I was, but however.
Did you have any interests? What would you do for leisure activities, you know, to enjoy yourself?
Well, if there was a chance, I used to go and see a football match. And then there was cricket. There was a cricket club, Oxhill Colliery, South Tanfield Colliery, as its correct name was. They had a good cricket team. And it was the football ground was right in front. The cricket field was right in front of where I was living. So we used to say that every Saturday, you know, in the summertime when there was cricket being played. And that was an interest to me, that was, although I was never a cricketer myself or never shone at it. I have got in with local teams, you know, and then I could, but I would never say that I shone at it. I scored 100 runs. No, I've never got so far as that.
Did you have any contact with the Church Lance Brigade or the Boy Scouts during this time?
Well, I always went to Sunday school, and my mother, she was a church woman herself, and I will say I attended the Sunday school. It was a tin way corrugated iron building. We used to call it the Tin Church. It was in connection with the Stanley Parish Church here. It was a mission church, as they called it. And I attended there and soon to school. And when we got the lads, when we were getting into teenage, there was Charlie Bone, Tom Bone, and Harry Middlemiss. We always attended the Sunday school, and I'm still a churchman. I may say that's one thing I've been practically all my life, but I'm Presbyterian now, or United Reformed Church. That's the name it has now, you know. The Presbyterians and what's that other denomination that joined up with us? The Presbyterians and the...
Besides that, when did you come to leave the brickworks?
When did I come to leave the brickworks?
What age were you then, roughly?
Well, I left the brickworks. It would be about when I was 21. And that was I wanted to be... I always had a fancy for engines, and to serve your time for an engine, it had to be done stoking the boilers. That was an apprenticeship for the engines. You had to serve the 3 year. You had to be a boiler fireman or boiler stoker for 3 years. Before you'll be granted a certificate to become a winding engine man. You see, well, I was fancied being a winding engine man. So I did my 3 year. Then you had to...
During this 3 years, which pit were you working at?
The Morrison. The Morrison. And part of that time was at the Louisa. Then when I came out, I was in the First World War.
Right. Before we... So let's take... You went to the Louisa first, did you?
Yes, I fired the boilers at the Louisa first.
What were these boilers for?
Oh, for steam. Generating steam for the winding engines and for the pumps and for the hauling engines. And then there was another big engine, the sawmill. It was used for cutting... They cut a lot of timber up, you know, in the sawmills, different lengths. Your pit pops would maybe be all about 40 or 50 feet long. Well, you cut them down into the length that you required. There would maybe be some 3 foot, some 5 foot, some 7 foot, some 11 foot for the different thickness of the coal. And that's what the timber was used for. But
so what did you have to do? What did it involve being a stoker for the boiler, for the main engine?
Well, the apprenticeship to be a boiler was a boiler fireman. No big Lancashire boilers, about 8 or 9 foot in diameter, and then they'd be about 30 feet long. There was 2 furnaces in them, and. There was a steam gauge on, and your water levels showed how much water there was in the boiler. You had a steam pump, what we used to call the donkey pump. That pumped the water into the boiler because you had water glasses, you know. Your water has to be always above the furnace tubes. You see, of course, you had a walking level. You were all right as long as your tubes was covered with water. But if it didn't, if that happened, it never happened with me. I didn't want it to happen. But if it did, well, your tubes, the two tubes, they'll become red hot on the surface. And then there was what they call a fusible plug. Well, it had lead in it. Well, when it was a safety device. And that would it would burn a hole through this lead plug, and it would allow the steam and water to go into the fire. It was a safety device, really, as well. It was never used with me, and I didn't want it to be used there. But of course, the glasses showed the amount of water. You knew where your water was in the boiler, you know. And there was a pump, your donkey pump. It forced the water against the pressure of steam that there was there, and it was plain to see where your water was in the boiler by your two glasses you had in front of each boiler. That's the way we knew where that was.
What did you stoke the boilers with? You'd have to actually shovel it in.
Oh, I shoveled it in. Oh, the shovel, it was tipped over onto a bench, what we called a bench, that we get it. It was loaded up with every day with small coal. It was coal that had gone through the screen. You know, the larger the coal is, the better value it has. And so all the small coal that was maybe under 2 inch or about the thickness of that, well, there was a grate, you know, that tipped the coals onto, that slid away down. Well, the small used to go through there underneath. That was the coal that we used to fire the boilers with. Yes, but...
That would be hot work as well, then, would it?
Oh, it was hot work in summertime, yes. Especially when they were doing a lot of coals. The harder, the faster the winders was winded coals, well, the more steam it took, you know. And
how many were there? How many stokers
there were there? Well, at the pit I was at the Louisa, there was 2 winding engines, there was 2 hauling engines, there was 2 electric generating engines, there was a sawmill, and there was a machine for creating a draft for the blacksmith's shop, instead of using the bellows, they should just turn a handle, and this engine was an air pump, you know, and it had a pressure of air, and that would increase the air pressure on your furnaces of the blacksmith's shop. That's the way that was heated.
How many men were on stoking with you on a shift at the Louisa?
There was two men along with me. That made three men per shift. Three men. There were six boilers, and we each had two boilers to stoke. And
did you have any other jobs on it, besides watching the water level and actually stoking? Did you have any other jobs that you had to do in that job?
Oh, no. They just had, well, you had your face to clean, you know.
How did you do that?
Well, you see that if the fire's been burning so long, there's a sort of a scar forms in it, a hard kind of an ash, you know. You see, to get that removed, you had to burn your fire down low, then that was left, you would turn it, the furnaces would be about 9 feet long, and you had to turn the fire over to one side, get a rake and rake all those scars out, and then turn what was left of the fire back again, get the other half raked out, and then when that was raked out, well, you could spread the fire over, and then your fire's burnt much better for it, you see, because there was able to get in through underneath the bars there, and that scar, well, there was some of those scars was very hard. In fact, even now, I think you'll find that somewhere these old pits has been, you'll find some of these big scars. They used to call them wall toppers. They used to put them on top of walls. I think the idea was, you know, to stop anybody from climbing up them, because these scars, well, if you put your hands on to pull yourself up with them, you probably would find those hard parts of that scar would scar your fingers, do you see? I think that was really the idea. But a lot of the old pit walls had these scars on the top.
Now, you were at the Charlie, then the Louisa, and then back to the Charlie while you were at the...
Yes, yes.
Were you at the Morrison as well, by the way?
That was after I came out of the army.
Right. How far away was the Louisa from the Charlie?
Mile.
About a mile.
Yes.
Now, where were you when the war actually broke out, August the 4th, 1914?
I was at the Louisa pit.
Yeah. Do you remember?
The war began in... When was it? What?
Fourth
it was
of
in August. August. Well, it was the beginning of June when I joined the army.
When the war actually broke out, were you expecting war to break out? Was it a surprise to you, or did you know that war was likely?
Oh, I think there was a bit of a notice, you know. There was a bit of a newspaper headlines that Austria and Germany and, well, they weren't agreeing, and it was no surprise to anybody that when the war began, because the newspapers kept you well informed, you know, and...
Were you on holiday the day? It was bank holiday. Had you gone away for a holiday?
Yeah. Well, I might have been working as a fireman. I used to work holidays, you know, and Sundays as well. I couldn't... And then there was sometimes... When it all depended what shift you were in. There was always someone at the boilers. There was a steam fan there that went continuously. And, well, when the pit was working, this fan was still... It was a 40 feet in diameter. This fan was on the surface. It was a Welsh fan, what they called a waddle fan. And that was supposed to be the best fans there was. It was an iron, constructed all of iron, and the wheel would be 40 feet in diameter. And there was a huge steam engine inside an engine house, you know, that. And it turned, the revolutions were about 40 per minute. And it varied a bit with that, you know, according to steam pressure, but that was about the normal speed that it went out. 40 revolutions a minute, that's 40 feet diameter fan.
When the war broke out, did you think of joining up? Because a lot of people did. Did you think of joining the army straight away in August or September 1914?
Well, I went to Newcastle, and I fancied being in the Guards Regiment. There was a recruiting depot in Newcastle on Tyne, and shortly after the war, I fancied joining. But I wanted to be in the Guards Regiment. And when I went to this recruiting office, I told him, like, I would like to join the army, but I would like to be in the Guards Regiment. Well, he says, you know, well, have you won this? I'll see what height you are. And he put us on a stand and, oh, he says, you're not 6 feet. He says, I was 5'11", I think, or 5'10", I forget now. But anyhow, he says, I'm sorry, I cannot take you into the Guards. But there was a regiment there that was, formed during the war, what they called the Tyneside Scottish. Now, he says, we have a good regiment here, the Tyneside Scottish. And he says, we'll be very glad to have you for that. Oh, no, I says, I want that. That was an infantry regiment, and it did a lot of service and good work out in France, the Tyneside Scottish. And then there was the Tyneside Irish. It was formed at that part of in Northumberland as well. But however,
you didn't want that. Why were you so keen on the Guards and not being in another regiment?
Well, I don't know why. A man's in a higher caliber, I think, when he was in the Guards regiment than what he was in the infantry. The Guards used to form a bodyguard for the Queen's Palace, and now, if there was any ceremonial parade in connection with royalty, where the war was paraded, the Guards had to parade alongside of them, you know, and it was more, well, I would say, a man was in the Guards, he was always looked upon in a higher rank, I may say, than what a man was that was just an infantry man. They were all for 6 feet men, and that's the reason I couldn't get in there. But so anyhow, that was early in the early days of the war.
So you thought it was the Guards or nothing, as far as you were concerned. Is that right?
When I went away, we went away into the Royal Engineers.
No, I mean, look, in August and September, as far as you were concerned, if you couldn't get in the Guards because you were too short, then you weren't going to join up.
That was the thing. I said, if it's not the Guards, it's nothing.
What, did they mind the recruiting?
Well, I couldn't say that they did until there was a notice put up on the pit.
Hang on, before we get onto that, so you went back to work down at the Louisa. You carried on working at the Louisa. Did the working of the pit change with the war? Was there a shortage of men, or did you have to work harder or more often? Did things change?
I would say there was no change. Unless later on in the war, as a good many of the miners did join the army, it meant there wasn't so much coal coming out, and that may have made there wasn't so much steam required. But I say, up to the time that I enlisted, I couldn't notice any change there was to my work in that way, you know.
Was there any reason why you transferred from the Louisa to the Charlie?
Yes. The reason I transferred was it was a good mile walk from the Charlie to the Louisa. And the Charlie pit was much nearer me home. And it was there wasn't any buses in them days, and you had to use Shanks's pony, and that meant way half over there and half over back was making a long day. Whether Charlie Pitt, I could reach a Charlie Pitt in 5 minutes away from where I was living. So I really went to the Charlie Pitt because it was more convenient. You see, there wasn't the walking to do. I got the same pay. And the job really was a bit better than what the Louisa was. There wasn't so many engines running. There was a lot of engines running and consumed a lot of steam, you know. But it was really a better job.
I'd just like to ask you now, before we come to the point where you enlist, was the fact that your father was killed underground one of the reasons that you had always worked above ground, that you hadn't gone down the pit like most people?
I would say that's quite true. Yes, it always rankled in my mind my father was killed in the pit. Although the time came when I was underground, I think for 5 or 6 years at engines. I wasn't a miner, but I was underground and operating pumps and hauling those engines. Holland, there was endless.
That was after the war, though. But
that was
after the war.
After the war, yes.
So it did make. Did it make you actually nervous going underground, or was it just you'd rather not do it?
Well, I couldn't say I was nervous. I was being associated with pits all my life, but it had some effect on me. I'd say my father was killed, and that was always. A reason that I didn't want to be a collier. He was a collier and a fall of stone. He was buried up with stone and killed.
Right. Now, I want now to come to when you actually did enlist. Could you tell me how you came to enlist? Because I believe you saw some sort of notice. Could you tell me that story?
Yes, there was a notice put upon the Charlie Pitt heap. Miners were urgently wanted for the Western Front. And I had a brother, as I told you, he was working down there as a miner. And I said to him at night, he was in a different shift to me, but when we got together again in the house, I said, did you notice that? Have you seen that? Notice it's on the pit heap. Miners urgently wanted for France. He says, yes, I've seen it. And he says, I'm going to volunteer for it. I says, you are? He says, yes. Well, I says, if you're going to volunteer, I'm going to volunteer. He was the means of me volunteering for that because I was always attached to him. He's an older brother than me, but that was the reason that I joined the army, because he joined the army to go to France.
Now, they asked for miners, but you weren't a miner, were you? You were a fireman.
Yes, but... There was no objection raised to it. In fact, there was men transferred from the infantry that volunteered to join into these miners' units. There's plenty of it that had no connection with mines, but...
So they weren't...
Well,
where did you go?
You can always learn if there's plenty of miners there to show you what to do. It's merely pick and shovel work, you know, after all this and done mining.
How did your mother, and I believe you were married by then, your
yes.
wife, how did they react when you said that you and your brother were joining up?
Well, I think they hadn't any objection to it. I'd already tried to get into the army, I tell you, and they wouldn't take me as a guard. I was too small, so it was nothing. I mean, the people were volunteering right and left. There's different one you heard of them. There's gone away to... into the army, this was due to the fact that my brother was going. That was the reason that I went.
Did they try and dissuade you at all? Did they tell you not to be daft, not to join up? Did they try and stop you?
No, I wouldn't say they tried to stop me. No, there was no one tried to do that. I think I volunteered for it, and there would be about 30. From the group of collieries, that was a group of about 5 collieries, what they call the Southmore group, and there'll be about 30 men out of the whole of them colleagues. I was including my brother and myself, you know, that enlisted for that.
Where were you told to report? I mean, you saw the notice, you discussed it with your brother. Where? What did you have to do?
Well, we first had to see the colliery doctor. That was Dr. Johnson, lived at South Moor. He was what they called the colliery doctor. If there was any accidents at the colliery or things of that kind, you know, connected with the colliery, you always went to see the colliery doctor.
What sort of inspection did he give you when you went to see him?
Oh, when he saw me, he says, "There'll be much trouble with you." And he said he thought I was a fine physical specimen. He was really pleased that a man, my type of man, wasn't listening. And he was very pleased with me. He sounded my chest, and that was the main thing. But I was young and full of vigour at that time, you know.
Did your brother get through?
Yes, my brother got through, but he wasn't the height of me, but he had no trouble. He got through, and there was another man along with me that I was friends with. He was firing the boilers as well, and he said that he would go with me to enlist. So there was really three of us went with him being, you know. But when he got to London and he was medically examined.
Hang on, let's keep that for a moment. You were at you had your medical exam. All three of you were passed by the colliery doctor.
The colliery doctor, but then we got a.
What happened after the colliery doctor had passed all of you? Then who sent you where? Where did you go from there?
Well, we all paraded at Shield Row rail station. That had volunteered to go, and we got into the train that took us to Newcastle.
I believe the colliery manager came with you as well.
He came with us, yes, Walter Scott, and when he got to Newcastle, there was a long bar opposite the railway station. You used to always call it the long bar. It was, I don't know whether it's still there or not, but it was it maybe not there now. But we were all invited in there, and then that would have a pint of beer. They stood them a pint of beer. Some didn't, but the majority of them, I say, they did. And that was what we got.
Did you have one of them?
I believe I did. Although I couldn't say I was a teetotaler. I couldn't say that I was a beer drinker at that time. But I believe I had one along with the lads as well.
Now, where were you going? Did you have to report to Newcastle Barracks or?
No, we got the train at Newcastle, and then that was our first journey to London. I don't think there was any of us that had ever been in London before, the train stopped at York. I remember the train stopped at York, and some of us got off, and I was one of them. Bill and several more. When we come back, a train had gone, so we had to wait till the next one. But however, we got to King's Cross, and from King's Cross, I think there was a man in charge of us. There was a man called Lawther. He'd been an old territorial and had done a good bit of service with the territorials, and he was really in charge of us. And anyhow, as I say, the few of us had got out of York, and we went out to the station, and we were under the impression it was about 15 minutes before the train went away, but it was only 5 minutes. And when we come back here, the train had gone. And the majority of the party, of the 30 party, was in that train that they went away. And there would be, there was my brother Bill and Ralph Curry. He was a man that was mates with me at the boilers. He was in that as well. He was the one that that it was under the impression that the train was leaving in 15 minutes' time. But whatever, we saw the station master. Well, he says, you'll have to go. And we told him, like, he says, I cannot do to stop the train. He says, we wanted to see if he could stop the train. But no, he says, if it was the King of England, he says, I couldn't stop the train. He says, that train's been signalling the way and it'll have to go. So he says, there'll be another train in about a couple of hours. So we got to King's Cross, and I think there was someone. Oh, it was this Lowther. He had an idea that we were, unless the station master had phoned it on that we were coming with the next train, he might have done that. But anyhow, we were accommodated first in the Whitehall. That I went to the Whitehall barracks there, you know.